Welcome to the Aki Podcast for Monday, February 20th, 2012. I'm your host, Dennis Trainer Jr., and today my guest is Ashley Sanders. Before I get to my guest, a quick question for you listeners. Send me a comment at Twitter at AkiPodcaster or at Facebook.com/AkiPodcast. This is the place normally where there'd be some bumper music and some rock and roll and get you all jumping up and down and excited, but my the way I'm conceiving this Aki podcast is a little more no frills, just a conversation between me and one other person who is interested in or deeply embedded in the Occupy movement, and that these conversations would be shared for other people deeply invested in and or embedded in the Occupy movement. So I was skipping all that, you know, music and this and that and the other highfalutin, you know. But perhaps, you know, perhaps now in week two we should begin to think about an upgrade. Does it need an intro? Does it need a bumper? Does it need anything else but me introducing my guest and then sharing with you the unedited version of our conversation? Which is what I'm going to do today. Ashley Sanders has worked as the youth spokesperson for Ralph Nader's 2008 presidential campaign. She's also organized extensively for Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, California, which is a collective committed to community sovereignty, bio-regional democracy, and alternatives to corporate control and capitalism. While there, get this, she helped launch Capital Legalized Democracy, Move to Amend, a national grassroots campaign to amend the Constitution to abolish corporate constitutional rights and organize local communities to declare independence from the corporate rule. In addition to this, Ashley is the author of the zine, distributed electronically and in paper at occupations around the country, called How the People Got Their Groove Back, What a Bunch of Farmers Can Teach a Bunch of Occupiers About How to Keep On Going. I'll link to that zine if you go to the description of this podcast at occupodcast.org. Look for the February 20th installment. And quote from the introduction. Quote, not so long ago, Americans witnessed the beginning of a mass democratic uprising. Thousands of average people, disgusted by greedy elites and corporate control of government, launched a movement that spread to almost every state in the nation. They did it to reject debt. They did it to fight foreclosures. They did it to topple a world where the 1% determined life for the other 99. And they did it, and they did all of it against incredible odds with a self-determined respect that stymies critics. The year 1877. The people, dirt-poor farmers who would become to known as populists. In our conversation, which I'm about to share with you, Ashley and I talk about her zine, How People Get Their Groove Back, What a Bunch of Farmers Can Teach the Occupy Movement. We also talk about the early days of the Freedom Plaza event in Washington, D.C., way back in October. And then we do go on to talk about ending with Move to Amend, something that Ashley has been working on for quite some time and is heavily involved in now. So without further ado, this is my conversation I had recently with Ashley Sanders.
Thanks for joining me, Ashley.
Thanks for having me.
So Ashley mentioned in your introduction your involvement with Peaceful Uprising and Tim DeChristopher. Can you talk about the connection between your work there and how that kind of tied into your work as an organizer for the Freedom Plaza event, the October 6th event?
Sure, yeah. So I worked for Peaceful Uprising as kind of a full-time volunteer, and I did a lot of organizing for them, but I also, I'm kind of a history buff, and so I also started teaching a social movements study group, and as I read through all sorts of books about past social movements, I got more and more excited about, you know, what it would take to actually create or kind of help facilitate a movement in our time that would fight things that people have been fighting for a long time, corporate power, the elites imposing their will on poor people and common people, and trying to control the world, basically. And so I was doing this at the same time as Occupy was starting to become an idea in people's minds. You know, it wasn't the Occupy movement yet, but people were talking about occupying public space and trying to create the world they wanted in these small squares and try to fight the machine in that way. And so I was really, really digging this idea And through some of the connections at Peaceful Uprising and some old connections from past work, I hooked up with a bunch of the people who were helping to plan Freedom Plaza in D.C. And it was just what I was looking for, because I think, you know, the American public isn't really used to this idea of a physical, you know, a physical taking of public space and using that as a way to organize and mobilize and capture people's imagination. So I was really interested in that idea of using public space in that way. And so I started planning with the October 2011 folks for that.
I was one of those October 2011 folks myself. And while we were planning this, before the call for October Wall Street came out, my thinking was that we need a massive show of force and occupation in the nation's capital. Obviously, since then, Occupy Wall Street has sprung up and showed us that, well, there could be occupations of public space all over the country. And it is a decentralized movement. Do you think that for this movement to go to the next level or to escalate, that we need a massive show of force in one place? And does that one place have to be the nation's capital eventually?
I think that's a really good question. And I think that it might be a both and kind of thing, because I think that the magic of the movement partly is that people can autonomously occupy wherever they are, and that they can have this kind of leaderless movement that pops up everywhere and is tailored to the needs of the community. But I keep thinking about the committees of correspondence that they had in the American Revolution, ways that they shared information and kind of got their message and their fight to cohere into a meaningful whole, even though there are lots of different people involved in it. And I think that Occupy movement, since it is decentralized, needs those mechanisms more than ever right now, especially as people have started to be evicted. And I also think that as people are evicted, it's time to regroup and decide what the next phase is. And for me, the spirit of direct action is to go to the place where, you know, the enemy is strong, but also where there are kind of chinks in the armor that you can get into. And I think Washington, D.C. is obviously the political center of this country and of empire as well. New York was the financial center. And I think it makes a lot of sense to focus droves of people on the financial and political centers. And we could do, you know, we could get a lot of bang for our buck by going there. And it's what it's really about, right? Is stopping oppression from the political elites and the financial elites. So I think that a mass gathering in D.C. is a really important idea for the future of the Occupy movement, for organizing skills and sharing and communicating, and for actually dismantling power structures.
There are a lot of obstacles to a massive occupation in Washington, D.C., not the least of which is that went by the time I had left, two encampments there, that although a lot of individuals were kind of friendly and in solidarity, the encampments were had a lot in common with the Montagues and the Capulets. They really, indeed, kind of thought of themselves as standing for different things. And to my mind, it was just some kind of evidence of the left eating itself a little bit. And
right.
I guess that connects to my question about this kind of horizontal movement that's drawing people who may have been narrowly focused on a specific issue. Peaceful Uprising, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure, is kind of narrowly focused on environmental issues, right? There's some people involved in Freedom Plaza who are narrowly focused on the peace movement or narrowly focused on economic inequality. And what the Occupy movement is doing is trying to bring all these things together under one umbrella. But in your experience and practice, is this horizontal consensus building process the most efficient way of going about that? Or, you know, can we touch the third rail here and say this movement could benefit from a few leaders?
Well, I am really committed to consensus as an ethic, and I think it's one of the transformative things about that, you know, has been one of the transformative things about this Occupy process, is that anybody can come and have a say and push the conversation in the direction that they want. But I think that there is also, just bluntly, there's a lot of ego going on. There's a lot of non-cooperation, and a lot of, in a movement that's horizontal, there's been a lot of horizontal hostility, groups eating, you know, themselves alive, or groups fighting with other groups over comparatively really kind of pitiful issues. And so I think that there has to be a way that people can come together and actually hash out the really difficult things that need to be hashed out. And I think and come to some kind of cooperative consensus on what they want to do and how they want to focus. And I think that process is really, really messy. And I think now it has to happen more than ever. But I also think that we shouldn't be, I've noticed that a lot of times when we talk about democracy, we have such little experience with it and such little experience with consensus that we think that it means that everybody kind of leaves their talents and skills at the door and joins in this conversation as blank, in the conversation as kind of blank slates. But we're all bringing a ton to this conversation, whether it's, you know, emotional stuff like our despair about the world or whether it's our skills and talents. And we need a place to hash out all the emotional stuff we're bringing into a space. And I think we need a place to say that there are people with really, really good and important skills, and they should be allowed to use those skills, you know, to the best of their ability. And that some people are really good at inspiring and speaking and kind of pushing a movement in a certain direction, and that we should allow those people to do that. And that doesn't, that's not the same thing as having a top-down hierarchical leadership structure that's letting people use their talents in ways that are important to the movement.
Yeah, I mean, it's well put. It's a nuance that, like you said, is lost sometimes within some of these circles who are trying to work together. I want to shift a little bit towards a really kind of fantastic document that you created and that you've been kind of sharing wherever you go. This Occupy zine titled How People Got Their Groove Back, with a subtitle, What a Bunch of Farmers Can Teach a Bunch of Occupiers About How to Keep Going. What can a bunch of farmers, which farmers are you talking about, teach us about how to keep going?
So I was talking in that zine about the populist movement at the end of the 19th century, and these farmers were facing really similar things to the Occupy, to the things the Occupy movement is facing today. They were facing foreclosures on their farms, mass poverty, an increasingly corporatist economic system, the growth and power of big banks, and the ravages of wars economically and emotionally on the country. And they were powerless from every, you know, perspective of power, but they got together and they mobilized to do all sorts of things to actually fight the status quo and dismantle the corporate and political power structures. Everything from forming an entire non-cooperative movement where they created their own cotton cooperatives for buying and selling, and also eventually a political movement where they tried to defy the power of the two-party system.
And you outline, or you point to historian Lawrence Goodwin's kind of four stages that successful movements go through, movement forming, recruiting, education, and politicization. And so what stage do you think that we're in currently?
I think that Occupy is definitely in phase one, which is movement forming. And some of the characteristics of that movement forming phase are that you develop a language of radical self-respect, that you declare your independence in some way, you create kind of a psychological and often a physical space to reject the dominant system, and you start thinking about possibilities for a new world as a collective. And I think Occupy, it's been messy, like I said, but I think that they've done a really, really good job of starting to do that. And that's why they captured our, you know, people's imagination, I think, because they were talking big and they weren't doing the typical leftist thing of saying, okay, we've got to be small so we can grow. They've said, this is who we are, and if you want to join us, you should, because we have a common plight. So I think they've done a great job of that. And I think what they are struggling to do, or we, I don't know who they is, what we are struggling to do right now is to accept that part of movements is then getting really organized, and we have to figure out what our message is. In other words, what our ideology is. That's a scary word to some people, but it's basically our set of beliefs that we want to share with the world. And we have to find a way to educate and organize people around them besides just having them come to our camps. And we need to find a way to agree on those things as an Occupy movement, or at least on some things. And then we need to figure out a way to politicize, in other words, a way to take it to power. And so far, we've done really fun and creative and interesting things, but we haven't done things yet that collectively threatened power in a real systematic way. And so we as a movement need to figure out a way to do that systematically. And I don't think that we can do that, you know, randomly, like some people doing this in New York, some people doing this in, you know, Oakland, whatever. We need to figure out some sort of coordinated plan. We can do our own things, but we need a core of coordination if we're going to actually take Occupy from something that is challenging people's minds to actually challenging the structure that creates reality for all of us. And I think that we have to stop being afraid of organizing and structure and planning in that process, and we have to stop equating planning with being hierarchical or organizing with being top down. So I think that we need to accept the next phases of the movement that we're part of.
And what's the reaction to this zine, this document that you've had from some of the occupies around the country?
I've gotten a very positive response from a lot of people, and especially people who have been doing this for a long time have been really glad about some of the things that I've written. And from some people who are more my age, I talk about this in the zine actually, but I really think that one of the biggest threats to the Occupy movement is this kind of spirit. It's a very like youth culture spirit of the most radical thing is to yell the loudest, or the most radical thing is to be the most explicitly, you know, anti-authoritarian. There are certain things that are kind of like the darlings of the radical world, like that seem more radical or more cool than other things. And so from those people, I feel like I consistently get a response that they think, I say this in a zine, but they think any kind of planning is basically being the man, or that if you have any kind of action that's radical that would actually transform power that doesn't fall into the specific kind of approved glamorous categories, then you're not actually radical enough. And so from those people, I've gotten a lot of just, I think, very, very shallow rejection of ideas, because there's a certain fashion to what's radical, and that fashion in a lot of ways has been glamorized by the Occupy movement. And so I think that we need to have a much, much deeper conversation about what the word radical means and what it would look like to transform power. And our commitment should be to transforming and dismantling bad power, not to a certain fashion of rebellion.
One of the suggestions that you make there assumes, and I'm trying to remember and look through my notes, but it assumes a national convention of occupies. And there was a movement, there was kind of a push to make this happen. But my sense is, and you know, one can never tell, I think, is that this Occupy convention that was slated for July 4 in Philadelphia is not going to happen, or not going to be engaged with by, you know, a critical mass of occupations. Is that one of the obstacles to implementing your suggestion that we start this Occupy party?
I think that we're just in a rebuilding phase, and I think a lot of people are confused about where to go next. And I think that we lost some people. We lost a lot of people in the evictions, and there was such momentum that a loss of momentum can be really damaging to a movement like this. So I think that it can take a lot of forms, but I do think that it is a really important idea for as many of us as possible to get in the same space and talk about what we want to do next, and also talk about, like I said, what does radical mean to us? What would it look like? What does dismantling power look like? And really get into those conversations beyond the surface level. And then also to learn skills and to learn about what we're fighting from different people who have different areas of expertise, so that we're all more educated, we have more skills, and we have a common purpose going forward. And you mentioned that I suggested an Occupy party. I do think that people have to figure out how to confront power where power stands. And I think that is the task of the Occupy movement. And that can take the form of direct action. It can take the form of political organizing and actually an actual political institutional force. But I feel like the question that we need to ask ourselves is, what actions work best to do what things? So a march works really well to demonstrate your self-respect and to get publicity and to recruit people. But a march isn't the thing that's going to make bankers run out of their banks and hand you all their money. And a direct action works well to intimidate power and to recruit people as well to what you're doing, because it's fun and fanciful and whatever, but direct actions to actually dismantle power have to be massive and coordinated and sustained and really serious. And you can pretend, for example, to ignore the power structure and say, I'm not political because I'm not engaging with Barack Obama, but his decisions are still, you know, dictating what the world looks like. So I also think you have to figure out your plan for how to radically challenge the political institution with your own kind of political institution. And the Occupy Party was, in ways, a tongue-in-cheek kind of solution to how to have a leaderless movement while also having a political institutional force. And I said, you know, we could just run everyone, and our candidate could be everyone, and we could wear masks, and different people could be spokespeople in this mask for our values, and it would be a way to organize and get our message out and actually defy power where power stands. But I think no matter what you want to do, you have to figure out a way to actually organize to dismantle power. Otherwise, we're not a radical movement, we're a phenomenon.
So would a write-in campaign where we're vote, where I'm everyone and I want, how big does that have to be, do you think, to be something that's directly influencing the power structures that you're talking about?
Oh, I think it has to be big, and I don't think that we're ready for it by any means. It's interesting reading the Populist Moment by Lawrence Goodwin. He talks about how the farmers tried non-cooperation. They tried dropping out and doing their own thing economically, and they were really successful at it. But what they ran into ultimately was that they needed credit to run their cotton mm-hmm. cooperatives, and they couldn't mm-hmm. get that credit from the banks. So they had to figure out a way to engage as a political institution with the people who had power so that they could recreate, you know, how money flowed in that society so they could actually do their non-cooperation kinds of things. And they formed a political party, and they did a good job of it. But Goodwin's point is that that party failed partly because there wasn't the radical education and investment in all parts of the country for that project. So there was a very shallow analysis, and they were co-opted. So I don't think that we should rush into it by any means. And I think that for a movement like that to succeed, people have to be committed to these principles of being radical and having radical self-respect, and they need to understand what the critiques are, and they need to understand how movements work. And if you do it too soon, it's really bad. So I don't recommend doing it soon. It has to be big, has to be educated, sustained, and come from a deep experience of personal radicalization and collective radicalization to actually work, I think.
Yeah. How do you balance that, I guess, kind of youthful wisdom that's coming from you now with what the other note that you were striking in the zine is that we're in a fucking hurry. We can't wait that long to get shit done. You know, we're in the last moment where, you know, it's going to matter. How do you personally strike that balance?
I think that's a great question, and I come to this as an anti-corporate activist and a democracy activist, but also as a climate activist. And yeah. I know that, you know, many reports say 2017, that's it. It's over, folks. Like, we've got to figure it out. And so I'm trying to balance that with what I know about history, which is the populist movement, for example, they took 20 years to form and create their ideology and start getting it out there. And we don't have that kind of time. But I always think about, I think it's a Buddhist kind of saying, but it says something like, times are very urgent, so we must go very slowly. And I think that we can do both. I think that we can make sure that we lay the groundwork and the education and the organizing skills that we have to have an actually sustainable and effective movement. But I think we can do it faster than we think that we can. So we shouldn't skip that step. But, I mean, we can call for a convergence. We can recruit people. We can do a lot in a short amount of time. And I think that would do a lot towards actually getting this movement off the ground and our wheels spinning. It would just be like front-loading a bunch of investment, you know, for several months and then hitting the ground and doing the work, basically.
The last thread that I'd like to talk about is one of the main issues that's kind of emerged to the top of the din of all the issues is getting money out of politics, and a lot of momentum is forming around Move to Amend from forces within Occupy and then forces without Occupy. And I know that you've just begun some work locally in Salt Lake City, correct? To start a Move to Amend chapter there. Tell me why you think this is so important.
Yeah, so I was actually working for a group called Democracy Unlimited when the Citizens United decision came down, and they are one of the people, one of the groups that instigated the coalition that's now called Move to Amend. So I helped to launch it a couple of years ago and then moved on to some other work. But I moved on to doing some climate work, but my experience is that everything that I try to do and everything that I know other people try to do to change the world and make it a better place runs smack dab into the middle of the problem, which is that corporations have all the power in this country and that they can foil all of the work that we're trying to do. So I basically did a kind of loop-de-loop and went back to where I started and said, okay, corporate rule is the most important issue because it affects all the other issues that we're working on. And if corporations didn't have power, and if we had a real democracy movement that said people should have a say in their communities about what happens to them, not corporations that exist for profit, then we would have a movement that could then allow for all the other things that need to happen that the Occupy movement is about. So for me, it's kind of the foundational issue. It's the gate issue. It's the thing that will affect all the other things that we're working on. And so I became really committed to revoking this idea that corporations are people with the same rights as humans have, and also getting money out of politics completely in the context of not just like kind of a campaign finance movement, but in the context of a radical democracy movement that is talking about sovereignty, who should decide and how, and that whose goal is little d democracy in the United States, not big D suit democracy in Washington, D.C. And so I think it's really important as a movement because it affects everything else we do.
I agree. So someone like you who's been involved with this issue for so long, and maybe you've been privy to or even participated in some of the words to thing or about the amendment, and I just want to read Section 2 of it and then ask you a question about it. Section 2 of the amendment, this is from movetoamend.org. I'm clicking the tab that says amendment. Federal, state, and local government shall regulate, limit, or prohibit contributions and expenditures, including a candidate's own contributions and expenditures, for the purpose of influencing any way the election of any candidate for public or any ballot measure. Was there some political calculations in including the words regulate and limit and not just leaving the sentence with prohibit contributions and expenditures and then publicly financing elections at the federal level?
You know, I actually wasn't. That conversation happened after I left and started doing other things, so I can't speak to it personally. Mm-hmm. But I know that the sentiment of the people in the Move to Amend coalition is abolishing. They're an abolitionist group, and they want to abolish corporate rule and abolish corporate money in elections. And perhaps they put that in there just legally saying that there could be a range of options, but that's why I'm involved, at least personally. In Wisconsin, for example, as late as 1848, it was a felony on the books. It was a felony for a corporation to donate a single penny to a political or charitable cause because people were so, you know, savvy about the way that corporations were able to control whole communities with their political and or charitable donations. So that's what I'm fighting for. I don't want to just limit. I don't want to get back to like pre-Citizens United because the world wasn't too great then. I want to get to a place where people have total sovereignty over corporations and we say there should be no corporate money in political elections whatsoever.
Does Move to Amend do anything? Does Move to Amend affect a political candidate's contribution war chest and political action super PACs? Or just the campaign's war chest?
So their goal is to do both. Their goal is to essentially end plutocracy. Rich people shouldn't have more power in a democracy. And so it would affect corporations' ability to spend, but would also, as a movement, seek to allow people to decide how much money should be spent by individuals in elections as well.
So in your view, this 28th Amendment, if this 28th Amendment is amended to the constitutions, then the kind of election cycle that we're experiencing now, where a super PAC actually might, you know, Mitt Romney's super PAC has more money and maybe more influence than Mitt Romney, but of course Romney's campaign is coordinating with them, that kind of scenario is going to go away, or at least the legal framework to make it go away will be this Move to Amend is strong enough to do all that. in your opinion?
Yes, it would pave the way for that to just be over, like zip, zilch, over. But the thing is, it's really similar in a lot of ways to the 14th Amendment that, you know, guaranteed former black slaves equal protection and due process under the law. They passed that. It's the legal framework for passing future laws. But it's not like, you know, black people woke up the morning that was passed and their lives were just magical and great. You know, it basically set the framework for them to create people's laws that actually then created the actual world that they wanted to see. So this is a groundwork move to allow then people to say, okay, well, we want to make a law that says no corporate money in elections, and then they can, whereas right now that democratic action is illegal or unconstitutional.
And what are the how big of a hill is this to climb for Move to Amend? I mean, I know this is getting a lot of play in the press, and a lot of people seem interested in it. Is it how does this get done?
Well, I think it's going to be if people are on fire about it, it's really important to a lot of people. It's on the radar of lots of different kinds of people. I actually just did a launch in Salt Lake, and usually, you know, as an activist, if you get 20 people to a meeting, you're clicking your heels. And we had over 100 people in this big auditorium at the library from all different political stripes who are totally jazzed about what we're doing and are ready to hit the streets and canvass to put a ballot initiative on the ballot. So it's really capturing people's imagination, and it's something that they're putting their time into. At the same time, you know, we, like everyone who's doing it, has no delusions about how difficult this task is. You know, we're going into corporate occupied territory, but we're not going to go there until we have millions of people on a grassroots level that have pushed from local to state to the federal government to make their demands heard. And so we realize also, you know, we're taking a page from past social movements. So we recognize that every group that has ever tried to create real fundamental change in the United States has gone straight into the heart of, you know, the enemy. So women who are fighting for suffrage went straight into the heart of patriarchy in Congress to do that. And abolitionists who are fighting slavery went straight into slaveholder territory. So we know what we're doing, and we know that it's a big, big task, and we expect it to be hard, and we expect pushback, and we expect it to take a long time. But we're also not going to quit because of that.
Great. Well, I think that's all the time we have. I really appreciate you speaking with me. That was really fantastic. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And that was your OccuPodcast for Monday, February 20th. Join me tomorrow, and my host will be Ray McGovern, who's recently back from his trip out west to Occupy the Truth in support of Private Bradley Manning. Again, I'm Dennis Traynor Jr. Find the OccuPodcast at OccuPodcast.org, Facebook.com/OccuPodcast. And we're on Twitter at OccuPodcaster. Peace.